being recounted in that story in Sodom and Gomorrah is you have two strangers in town, and, you know, a mob of people, presumably men, wanted to basically rape them. And in those days, if you looked at homosexuality, if one man took the passive role in the sex act, he was considered equivalent to a woman. And so this was an act of dehumanizing someone else by rape. And we know that because in many times, you know, the records are there, when armies conquered another army, you know, we won, we're the king on the mountain, one of the ways they would denigrate the losing army is through rape, you know. So, and not only that, but it had to do, and this is again what they were referring to, the prophets, is the real lack of hospitality. If you didn't welcome the stranger and take care of the stranger could literally die. You know, it was a life and death situation. And so the prophets always spoke of the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah as the lack of hospitality and brutal injustice. All right? Jesus refers to Sodom and Gomorrah, but it had to do with the inhabitants of Sodom will rise up and condemn this generation. Why? Because had they experienced what this generation experienced, they would have changed their minds and been converted. You have more than they have, and you're not believing, and you're not converting, and you're not changing. So, you know, those are interesting aspects of all of this. I'm not advocating for gay unions. I'm just saying, you know, we can't go back to Sodom and Gomorrah and say this is why. I mean, God destroyed the cities because of that, and now God's going to destroy America because of it. I think we're destroying ourselves because of many of the things that we're doing. Yes? Well, there are several citations. You know, Leviticus makes reference to it. Romans makes reference to it. But it doesn't tie it directly to Sodom and Gomorrah, number one. And number two, what Romans is getting at specifically is cultic behavior where people were going and practicing fertility rites with males. Males with males, because these males would be androgynous or take on the appearance or fill in for the goddess kinds of things. So it was connected very clearly with idolatry. But no, there are many references that says this is not to be done. All right, and we go back to natural law, the complementarity of the sexes. Did you have another point?
Well, two actually, but I don't want to talk too much, but they're quite separate. Let me say the first one. I think that if in fact the church has become countercultural, has always been, but is now big time in spades becoming countercultural because of what's happening in our culture, in our nation, then what I am losing is a sense of what I grew up with as a young person, the thinking of America as the New Jerusalem. There's a great new Christian faith-based movie out called Beyond the Mask, which takes place in American Revolutionary times. It's hard to get to see it. I mean, I haven't seen it on around here, but it's getting a lot of, it's a swashbuckling adventure movie, but it has basic Christian values in it a lot. It's time to place, time of the American Revolution. But, you know, I grew up with this sense that America is, in some way, the new Jerusalem, the new attempt in modern times to establish a morally righteous country, nation. And we were the beacon for the world. Mm-hmm. It seems that in our government, we've lost the sense of that. Not everybody in the government, but we're not shining or flashing that message to the rest of the world anymore. We just think that we're going to be one of many nations and we're all the to the people and to share whatever we've got. If in fact the culture is sliding, if you will, in the same way that Europe has already slid, then I guess I've lost my country, so to speak, or anyway, I've lost my image of the New Jerusalem as America, you know, the Star Spangled Banner that I had when I was much younger, just gone. So I feel like I've lost my dream. The church is going to move on in the world to South America and China and India and Asia. It's already doing that, and that's great. I guess that's maybe part of God's plan, but North America is going down the tubes, and so I worry about that for my grandchildren, or great-grandchildren. Should they move to India? Maybe. You know, I don't know if they want to be surrounded by a believing community. I don't know. Okay, that's one point, and I'll think of the other one in a minute.
Okay, but in all fairness, I see what you're saying, and we've become increasingly secular. You may remember a psychologist named Carl Menninger, who wrote a wonderful book in the 50s, Whatever Happened to Our Sense of Sin? You know, and so this has been going on for a while, and I think in all fairness, our government is a reflection of the culture. I mean, where did these people come from? You know, they grew up in our culture, they are now at that point, and they have established themselves in power, whether they're the liberal elite or whatever. You know, we end up with a situation where they're reflecting our culture. And when you talk about Europe, you know, when Europe, you know, the European Union went to write its constitution, if you will, the Pope in Rome appealed to them directly. You know, because part of that sort of recounted the history of how we came to be where we are. And one of the drafts simply completely left out any reference to the influence Christianity had on the building up of Europe. And they ended up writing it out of their constitution. They have become so secular. That's what's happening here. We're becoming increasingly secular. When we detach ourselves from biblical principles, then we are no longer a faith-based community. And I think that's what you're talking about. And in our founding, you know, let's face it, whether you were Catholic or pilgrims or whatever, you were escaping, you know, a situation in Europe where you were not free to practice your religion. Now, we weren't always that tolerant at the beginning of each other. You know, William Penn was the one that kind of established that kind of religious tolerance that didn't exist before. Let's face it, if you were in the Catholic communities, Protestants and Jews, you know, please go elsewhere. If you were in the Protestant communities, it's okay, Catholic and Jews, you go elsewhere. You know, and it was William Penn that kind of helped to establish that sense of religious tolerance. But yes, I mean, read our Constitution. There are clear faith statements in that. And there are people today that want to like rewrite that and wipe those things out of there, or simply redefine them so they don't exist. But I'm just saying is that once we do that, then the things that are happening now ought not to be a surprise, like that one pastor said, look.
Yeah, and the other thing is, if in fact we are to think, we do think of America as taking that secular slide, whereas with the church become countercultural, what do we make of the now very large, significant church groups who have endorsed such things as gay relationships, ordinations, and gay relationship marriages? Are we to think of them, those very large church groups, as just having sold out to our secular sliding culture?
They, again, I would say yes. I would say yes. Others will say no, this may be, you know, an act of revelation. I'm not sure, all right? I don't want... You know, I give the Pope a great deal of credit. I mean, obviously it's hooray from my side, but I give him a great deal of credit saying, you know, we need to have a profound respect for everybody, all right? That doesn't mean we have to agree with everything you're doing. But you know, we've had a tendency to kind of equate, the sin with the sinner, and as a result, we've not been, and I think this is part of the problem, we have not been as kind or as respectful as we should have been. And so when you're not that, then people fight back. And that's what they've done, you know. So I think we've got to go, but I'm going to disagree with you. I mean, I don't think we're the New Jerusalem and the shining city on the hill that Reagan referred to any longer. But I don't think that we ought to abandon it. I think, you know, I think we as Christian people need to clarify what it is that we believe, and I think we need to be able to articulate it not without a profound sense of judgment, but a profound sense of love. Understand that when Christianity grew and developed in a pagan world. And the morals of Romans and Greeks were very different than what the church was espousing. You know, and it thrived in the midst of that, because people began to look for direction. And so in a world where you had all kinds of competing ideologies, the church stood strongly for certain things. And people were attracted to that. Right now, people have found that organized religion, for instance, is lacking in some way, shape, or form, and are abandoning it wholesale. Probably because we haven't been a very good job of doing what we said we were doing and being who we said we should be. And I think now is the time when we need to get back to that. And it's not just in the issues of marriage, it's across the board. It's across the board. Yes?
Well, Romans 1 tells us that after committing all these sins, that God turned them over to a depraved mind. He abandoned them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some sense that because we have erased God from our schools, and even some of our churches don't even say we use God, or they say we don't use Christ as their good, that God has abandoned those kinds of things, turn them over to a depraved mind, and we're seeing a lot more depravity around here.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is a revival.
Well, yeah, as long as it's... yeah, I know what you're talking about. You know, historically, I remember some of those revivals, we didn't end up too well. we were kind of written out. But no, we do, and I think that, again, I'm going to come at it from a little bit of why I know is that the popes in, you know, since the 60s have really spoken of the necessity of true evangelization, you know, your revival, of getting the truth out and to use the means at our hands in order to speak the truth. Now, I believe it was Benedict, I'm not sure, but he, and maybe this was prophetic, is that what this gentleman is referring to, I think, is going to be true, is that the church is going to shrink substantially. And, you know, and then it's going, you know, if that point happens and we are who we are supposed to be authentically, he could foresee that it would build back up. And I think that, go back to Israel. You know, Israel would get off the mark too, remember? And there would be these really horrendous things called exiles, you know, and it would be for a long period of time. It was when they got their act together as a remnant people and began to get back to their covenant relationship with God that God was able to reestablish them. And I think that's what has to happen. You know, I don't like that idea. You know, I look in my own tradition, we have, you know, again, because of the culture, first of all, we have much smaller families. You know, there was a time when, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10 kids was not unusual. Now it's 1 or 2. And you know, where is the clergy going to come from if we shrink our families down to nothing?
Well, think each one of us, in a sense, is a clergy person.
Oh, yeah, no, no.
Responsible
yeah.
to share Christ and bring
Oh, absolutely.
Christ.
That was the whole point of today's Mass, is that the light... See, I live in the ivory tower, you know, in a certain sense. I mean, I'm professionally a clergyman, and so I have to say certain things and behave certain ways, even though I drive a convertible, you know. You know, but I'm not in your workplaces. I'm not in your families. I'm not in your neighborhood. You know, which is why the laity, as you refer to, need to assume the role of evangelization. You bring Christian principles into your workplace, into your families, and like that. And that's essential. The priest or the minister on Sunday can't do all of the work, no matter how good he is at preaching. You know, it has to be lived out day by day in the home, in the workplace, in the neighborhoods. And that's how I think that we're able to, if you will, to present the truth of the gospel into the world today. Yeah.
Our leader now is the first president who will not participate in the National Day of Prayer. He neither comes nor does he send a representative from the executive branch. No one can figure out exactly why, because he goes to other prayer gatherings of other denominations, but at any rate, it says something. Your own leader will not come to his own National Day of Prayer.
Yes.
Can you say something about the theology of the body?
Oh. In 25 words or less. There is a movement, there is a theological perspective that arisen in the Catholic Church called the theology of the body. And it's centered in a very real way in natural law. You know, in terms of, you know, we are created in a certain way to function in a certain way. You know, and that we are not disembodied, but we're corporeal beings. And in that corporeal being, you know, and you know, we're also a sexual being. All right, we can't get away from that. You know, I'm male, you're female, and in that essence, you know, we function in the world, even though we're human, we function in the world differently. You know, we have different makeups of ourselves, and we need to respect that in each other. We need to value each person, each gender's unique gifts and insight and experience of the world, because we experience it through our bodies. You know, and I'm not prepared to really go into it, to be honest. Because it gets really interesting, because you can bear children and I can't, you have a whole different perspective of the world. All right? And in theology of the body is that somehow or other we need to connect and to understand that. You know, and but they've written several books on it, and I got to tell you, it became a theological issue after I got ordained, and I'm not conversant with it yet. But Christopher West is a very good, if you want to read anything on that, Christopher West is very good. No. Yeah. No. It has to do with an understanding. And I could say things, but I don't want to say them on tape.
Well, I think it's like a reference of your sexuality.
Correct.
It's a
correct.
Reference of your maleness.
Your maleness.
And I think some of the popes in your time
Oh, yeah. Well, no, St. John Paul II was very much a proponent of it, and that's where it began to take off, is under his papacy. And it's taught in the seminary now, but I was through the seminary by then, and I'm not as conversant on it as I should be, but I'm getting there. Yes, sir.
You mentioned a minute ago that our leaders reflect our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the famous philosopher who wrote the old Township Hogo talked about that. He said, we met the enemy near us.
Yeah.
And we have recently a book about Bonhoeffer who said, to be silent in the face of evil is in and of itself evil.
Sure.
To not speak is to speak, to not act as you act.
Mm-hmm.
So each one of us as individuals needs to do what Christ or God tells us through Paul in Ephesians. You must always speak the truth, but in love, gently, and patiently. Mm-hmm. But you must speak the truth.
And consistently.
And do what you say you believe. That's right.
Now, I'm celibate, okay? So I don't have a wife and I don't have kids. But as I look around and as I've been watching things in my long life, I have seen parents abdicating their responsibility of teaching the truth to their children, leaving it up to other people. It's uncomfortable, and so I don't do it. And as a result, who's doing it? I mean, how many of you remember, and because it's still true and it's getting increasingly so, we send our kids to college and they come back atheists or agnostics. Well, because we didn't really pass on the faith as we should have, and so who's got their attention but these agnostic and atheistic, you know, teachers? I will never forget, I'm junior, senior in college, and I'm a psychology major. And I'm sitting in this psychology course, a brand new professor with long hair and a ponytail, and, you know, this is back in the 70s. You know, not uncommon, except this is a Catholic college, and this guy comes in and begins every lecture talking about the primitive superstition of religion and how intelligent people are not going to buy into this and how foolish we are if we are doing this, that we need some big daddy in the sky to tell us what's right or wrong, and we can't take responsibility for ourselves because the big daddy in the sky is really nothing more than a psychological creation to whatever. You know, I listened to this for about 3 weeks, and I was taking him because I was trying to get my major finished. It was my last semester, so I was a senior. And I was trying to get that, you know, my requirements completed. And so I was taking his courses because he was the only one teaching them. And finally, after 3 weeks hearing this in every class that he taught, and I think I was in two of his courses, I finally stood up and said, Professor, I am a believing Christian, and so are most of the people in this classroom. In fact, we're Catholic, and you're teaching in a Catholic college. And personally, I'm tired of you bashing me because I'm a man of faith. And I would appreciate it if you would stick to the course material and not your personal beliefs. To which point, the entire class stood and applauded. All right? We reach a point where we need to have the courage to stand up and say enough is enough. You know, and I think, again, I personally believe that somehow, and this is a successive generation, you know, that the faith has not been passed on, and therefore our families are not passing it on to the children. And so they're left to be influenced by these strongly secular, you know, where families are strong in their faith and have passed on their faith, the kids are faith-filled. You know, for the most part. Though I have these wonderful members of my parish who say, we did everything we could. We put them in a Catholic school, we went to church every Sunday, we prayed as a family at home, and now none of our kids go to church and they have nothing to do with organized religion. Again, I know we don't like the phrase, it takes a village to raise a child. I can't do it by myself. If the rest of the community isn't supporting that, then the peer relationships are going to kick in and people are going to go elsewhere. There's a synergy in our culture right now that is anti-religious. Correct. And again, we need to get back to that. And there, you know, I'm going to go back to that whole sense of the stability of family life, I think, is incredibly important. If over 50% of our marriages are ending in divorce and kids are ending up in broken homes, what's happening? You know, we have a whole slew of kids out there then that have no stable connection, you know, and that's why I think this whole marriage thing is extremely important. I really do. Yes? Well, he was still there when I left. I don't know. He was reported to the authorities. I aced his courses. I would have to say that again, his exams were on the course material, and I handled that very well. So, but I mean, the fact that the class stood and applauded, and then I'm in his next class, and he looked at me, and I was ready to stand up and do it all over again. He could see that.
Well, you know, there's a man from Lebanon, Harold Fromm, who made a movie, God's Not Dead.
Yes.
Predicated on just your situation.
Right. And have you seen that movie, God Is Not Dead? It's very good. It's very good. Yes, sir?
Earlier this month, there was an ABC Washington Post poll asking people whether they supported the action of the Supreme Court. And the number of the percentage of people that identified themselves as Catholic was a higher support level than those that identified themselves as non-Catholic. Does that say anything to you?
It says that we got work to do. You know, it says, you know, first of all, I think there comes to be sometimes a confusion about Catholics are very much wanting to be fair and very much not wanting to be discriminating people, you know, wanting to be inclusive as possible. And somehow or other, I think that desire overrides this other sense of what is really right. You know, in terms of what marriage ought to be. You know, it was interesting. I had a discussion with a couple of priests who are very disappointed in the Supreme Court ruling because the Supreme Court says it's marriage. They wish the Supreme Court simply would have said that we should allow civil unions with all of the rights of marriage, but not call it marriage. You know, and so I think maybe you get into that kind of a situation where people are making equations that ought not always to be the case, you know, because you have issues. And I've dealt with this, you know, very, this is on tape and I'm gonna get in trouble. Cut the tape, no. Then I'll get in more trouble. Like, why did he cut the tape? In my priesthood, I have encountered same-sex couples that have been absolutely faithful and devoted and committed to each other for 25 and 30 and 50 years. You know, quiet, nobody knew about it. Of course, this is before legalized marriage. And run into the situation where the extended family didn't approve of it, and ran into this a lot when the AIDS thing was exploding. You know, where they were maybe a couple for 4, 5, 10 years, and one of the partners is in the hospital with AIDS, and the families refuse to allow the partner into the room to see. And then at the time of death, completely froze the partner out. All right? This is part of where the fight got, you know, really got going, is how can you do that when there was a genuinely loving, caring, supportive relationship, you know, and call it a friendship. I mean, if you were my friend and I was dying, I would want you there as well as my family, and for my family to tell you, well, we don't like him, so he can't come in, and to tell the nursing staff to keep you out, or not to include you in my funeral when we've been best friends for years, there's something wrong in that, all right? And I think this is part of where this fight came, because if you don't call it marriage, then I don't have the right to be there. And, you know, and then it got more complicated, because then you got to adopt kids and, yes? Practicing?
Practicing, or really knowledgeable.
Or maybe they're in New York and San Francisco.
But you're not, nowadays, you hear someone's Catholic, they may or may not really know their faith, but if they go, you go to church. And that would, when I was growing up, that wasn't true. Catholic practice, they went to church on Sunday and they followed it. But today it's very, very different.
Well, we have a name called Cafeteria Catholics.
Right.
And, on CNN, I was surprised, there's a person there called Smirkanish, and he brags about being a cafeteria Catholic. You know, I'll believe this, but I won't believe that. I'll practice this, but I won't practice that. So you may be getting some of those.
You mentioned one time consideration about fairness and people legally, and we're all created in the image of God. I heard on a lawyer, a retired lawyer, a lot of people who came in who professed same-sex couples and wanted to go off the government, and probably because of that, was part of the last day on earth, part of the funeral ceremony and all that. It's easily fixed, and we did fix it by giving a verbal power of attorney.
Correct.
So a lot of that, the only real disparity comes in what the government recognizes as tax benefits.
Correct. That's part, yeah.
Marital benefits. That's where the only difference came. So the Supreme Court has now changed everything to just deal with that one narrow thing that they were deprived of.
Right. There were legal remedies, and but I was dealing with people who didn't know that or never went through that. And so there was a moral thing. But by the Supreme Court defining it now as marriage, I think we've really muddied things. You know,
if you read Justice Kennedy's opinion, you stated it very well. It comes down to whatever pleases me, I should have what I need.
Correct. And certainly I think that was in Roe versus Wade. I have a right over my own body to do as I please with my body. So, you know, so I mean that those principles were put into the public forum back then. Correct. Correct. But we've muddied the waters a lot. And so, again, I don't know if we're ever going to put the top on, we're ever going to close Pandora's box, at least not in the short form. But I do think that in the long term, we have to teach what is morally true. And hopefully, in turn, it will be reflected.